Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I am your host, Nick Shutt, here with a brand new episode. Very excited to have it's actually our first episode with more than one guest, Mr. Dave Jefferson and Mr. John Mark Suhi here with us. Gentlemen, if you would please introduce yourselves, a little bit about yourself, your background, and how we got here. Dave, why don't we start with you?
Sure. Thanks, Nick. It's great to be here. I guess keep to the interesting parts of my background, but I've been kind of knocking around the Beltway for about the last 20, 25 years, in a variety of roles, kind of on all sides of the equation. I started out my career in the military in the Marine Corps. Spent some time working with classified systems. Kind of came up through the military, first beginning to kind of understand how to use computers on the battlefield. From there, I transitioned into the private sector, worked for a European-based company that was building telecom systems, started work, at the ground level as a software engineer developer. From there, I had a number of successive jobs, but ultimately it landed me in an interesting space in the nonprofit world, where I worked for an organization that was a public-private partnership that was really focused on helping government leverage technologies from Silicon Valley. But I think we'll talk about that more later on. But from there, I went and hung out my shingle. Started my own defense contracting business, was able to successfully grow that, get acquired, took some time off, then decided to do it again with another company. And so I'm recently coming off of that and working with a number of companies around the Beltway, just helping them execute growth strategies. So
Fantastic.
that's my story.
Thank you for your background. I really appreciate that. And I also appreciate appreciate you taking time. Congratulations on the recent exit, man, and the previous one. I know how much work goes into that, so that's fantastic. John Mark, if you don't mind, would you just tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of how you got here as well?
Sure. I started off in as an entrepreneur, focusing on the private sector, and then I got pulled into the government, starting off with intelligence and solving problems that were complex and bringing new technologies with us to solve them. And I worked with the IRS, say MPO, you could say Maryland Procurement Office, FBI, Sandia Laboratories. And a lot of it just bringing in new technologies, everything from graph databases to large language models, and solving problems. It's something I've always done as an entrepreneur. And I joined Greystones. We actually merged about 2 years ago, and we were missing the business side of things, and I wanted to be able to have a bigger and better team to be able to solve these problems the government's having and do it efficiently, cost effectively. It's been
Absolutely.
fun. Yeah.
I'm sure it has, man. That's fantastic. And I appreciate that as well, John Mark. And you kind of hit on the theme of our overall episode today as we talk about efficiency and cost savings within government. There's I think especially considering the time we're in right now, with a recent administration change about 3 weeks ago, 3 or 4, 3 weeks ago now. I think there's a tendency to, cast it and try to cast it in a very political light. And but at the end of the day, we all know that there's a lot of inefficiencies in the government. Both sides of the aisle completely agree on that. I think anytime you're spending a couple of trillion dollars a year, there's going to be inefficiencies, right? But especially as we continue to look at emerging technologies, as they continue to, as we continue to push forward, there have to be a lot of interesting opportunities to increase efficiency. But before we get into that, can we give a little bit of background? Could you guys speak a little bit about your experiences working with the last efficiency initiative, the bipartisan one that happened in the 90s? Dave, I believe you were involved in that, correct?
Yeah, so Nick, one of the things I mentioned in my background is that I had worked for a nonprofit organization. And so Our goal was to work with government to help kind of transfer technologies from Silicon Valley into the government. And so it's from that perspective that we began working with the government on their bipartisan effort to create more efficiency in government. And it went by the name, the National Performance Review. Very similar goals to what many administrations like to do. They had a lot of successes. I think when you go back and you look at the efficiency, they claim that they save government somewhere between $2 and $4 billion. They were able to re re I think the word that they used at the time was rework jobs. And so they created 300,000 reduction in jobs that they were able to put into other areas within the government to make it more efficient. And some of the you know and so some of the successes that they really had were related to technology, right? The 1990s were a time when government was just beginning to get on the cusp of the internet, right? And to leverage those technologies. And so in the organization that I was part of, we've for example, helped government implement some of the very first websites that federal agencies ever had. We worked with them, for instance, at the Veterans Benefit Administration to use digital technologies, right? OCR scanning and other things to create more efficiencies. And so all in all, when you look at the effort, when government really sets its mind to leveraging technology to make things better, they can create a lot of successes.
Absolutely, they can. I think that's been proven a lot, especially over the last, call it 120 years from like 1905 to present. I think we've really done a really good job as the US government of implementing technology. It's fantastic. What were some of the, it's fantastic that you were involved and got to see a lot of that, Dave. And what were some of the challenges you guys experienced working through that process?
Most of the challenges were challenges that I would say you encounter whether you're in government or not. And it's the example that I always use of the let's say person who has grown up with her favorite version of WordPerfect software. And so when you go from WordPerfect to Word, there's that learning curve, right? There's that unfamiliarity with, new technologies and, what are you taking away, right, before the individual thinks about what they're getting. And so lots of what we had to do was really kind of socialize technology with, different agencies and with different individuals so that they could understand, how at the end of the day, there might be a learning curve, but ultimately it was going to make things better, right, for that agency and for them to complete their mission.
Absolutely. What are some of the lessons learned? What do you think, and what do you think that what do you think that you guys learned back then that can be applied to today in the current efficiency push?
I think some of the things we learned that were really effective is that in many instances, the way that you have to do a technology rollout is you have to consider the user. The idea that you're just going to come in, throw technology right into an agency and have them sink or swim isn't a good method to try to produce a favorable result. So socializing what you're trying to do is really, really important, right? And so in effect, one of the things that we always did is we kind of marketed the initiative internally, right? It wasn't simply, hey, we're throwing in a new technology and here's some books and get used to it or figure it out. We would often kind of sit down and have lunch and learn sessions where we kind of talked about, what they were trying to do as an organization, and how different approaches, different ideas might help them get there and kind of slowly bring them along to where they needed to be in order to be able to accept it.
Absolutely. And what you say resonates a lot with what I saw before, just before the new year, end of December, I had Bill Pratt on the podcast. Bill Pratt was a director at DHS for the last 10 years before he retired. And he's actually the gentleman that rolled out Agile, the Agile framework within DHS overall. And some very similar approach of going out and marketing it to different offices, helping them understand the benefits of it, getting a couple of key wins, and then using them as the example and the roadmap and getting everybody else to kind of follow. It is collab. I mean, it does take time, especially compared to private industry. But I think that that's kind of a feature of the government system, not a bug, so to speak, where change is going to take time. Overall, John Mark, do you have anything on kind of this and that effort?
It's funny, I don't really have any experience with politics on side of things. I'm sort of the type of person that comes and throws in the technology and says, here's what we need to do. And then I get hit with all the issues trying the logistics of trying to get something in here, but push back the technology not being supported and whatnot. So,
Absolutely. And so understanding kind of from the 90s to today, and how technology's changed, obviously the, over the last, call it, 3 years or so with, OpenAI and release of ChatGPT, AI has really become far more prevalent in like culture and media in general. How does that change things? How does that change the ability to create efficiencies within the government?
well, huge changes. I mean, and I've noticed too that a lot of agencies are hesitant on adopting it yet because there's, you have to deal with bias and all these issues that they're starting to figure out that are coming out when you bring this into the, into the government, especially any large language models, and they're kind of closed down. You don't know how they're operating. But I've seen everything from software development, being able to quickly build solutions that you'd normally go out and spend, $10 million on the vendor coming in to do it. Being able to help with, I think the biggest piece or the biggest thing I've seen right now is augmenting humans. So, not replacing them, though that's probably going to be an issue coming up soon. But augmenting, making you better at what you do, investigators, helps desk support. Teams, whatnot.
Absolutely.
I
I think
apologize if I go off a little bit because I forget sometimes what you asked me, and about
it's okay.
15 seconds later, I've already forgotten what the question was.
I listen, I'm the same way. I totally understand. Sometimes I don't know where a sentence is going when I start talking, but I figure it out on the way, right? No, and I think that studies that I've read have said that folks that use generative AI as a function of doing their job, so augmenting what they're doing, are somewhere between 40 and 60% more productive than those who aren't. So I'm inclined to agree with you that it is going to help folks. What areas do you think are, let's just say, ripe to be replaced first?
I think support and like help desk support, like IRS, for example, has a help desk and a website where you can come in and ask questions. I think that's going to be the first, the type of things that are going to be replaced, or the generative AI. I'm only talking about generative AI right now, but I think that's going to be one big piece. Fraud analytics, being able to go in and review like documents or data in a database and summarizing it for you, like huge amounts of data that would take an analyst, like 2 weeks to go through. You can go and pass it in using RAG, retrieval augmented generation, and say, give me a summary of where these inefficiencies are coming in, spending and whatnot. And I think software development and creating solutions, they're creating apps and I guess APIs and solutions to a business need. That's going to be, I mean, we do that all the time now. So in our internal, we use generative AI to build, all our test cases, help us build actual software. But it started off being real simple. You could build some scripts, and now it can build entire applications, the UI, the back end. It's amazing what's happening right now.
That is amazing. How well do they do How, for when you think about, comparison from a skill perspective, where do you think they kind of land now? Is it like a senior level person solving, new problems that come up, or are they more like a mid-level, junior level where they're just kind of working on existing issues and working on, let's just say, well-documented problems?
I think a junior, maybe a little mid-level, but it's getting better and better. And so, especially with agents being able to do reasoning and breaking down complex tasks and whatnot, and having access to the code, the documentation of what the problem is you're trying to solve. I think it's within the next 2 years, it's going to be tackling more of senior level type tasking. So you're gonna be left being the orchestrator. Like, who's the person that does Hans Zimmer? I have a feeling there's gonna be the Hans Zimmers, and they're gonna have their orchestra is gonna be all the AI. So there's still gonna be a need for the creativity of for the well, it depends. I don't know what AGI is gonna look like, so I could be wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, based on your timeline, you think it's going to be 2 years for AGI, John Mark?
Oh, AG, I don't know. If I was to guess based on everything I've heard, maybe 5 years, but who knows? Who knows?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would just wanted to add to the conversation. I think one way to think about it is, where we are with AI is comparative to in the early days of dial-up internet, where you had real networks and you were trying to watch these, photo size streaming video, right, shows over the internet. In reality, that's where we are today with AI. We still don't quite understand all of the capabilities that it can bring in some of these areas, and for a lot of reasons, because the models themselves need to get more mature, right? And then our ability to use those models, our ability to do more effective prompts, right, to get the information that we need. But I think as that increases, what you're going to see is you're going to see agencies who have a better understanding of how they'll use this technology. It'll certainly be driven in many areas by the mission, right? If you're a defense organization, you're going to look at the technology and begin to understand how it can help you complete the mission better. I think other agencies are going to do exactly what John Mark said, right? Which is, this is a cost savings if we can use, generative AI to replace, the work that somebody does on a help desk, right? Responding to a query.
Absolutely. Yeah, and a friend of mine, I know a friend of mine, and I've mentioned this on the podcast before. He works for a large one of the a large company in the technology space, and they weren't giving him additional funding to hire additional help desk people. So he just automated all of tier one support like 2 years ago, right? Like, so it's and if that's what we were doing 2 years ago, even if it was. It's not the same as, say, SSA, Social Security, or any of these other, like, it's not a technology forward organization like these large technology companies are. However, if you're able to do that at a tech company 2 years ago and understanding the exponential kind of improvement that we've been seeing, I'm inclined to agree that it's going to be very soon. And I also don't. I really like your example of comparing where we are to dial up, though, Dave. I think that's really puts it into perspective because it is really, really early, right? Yeah. So, how do you guys see AI being utilized and implemented in a lot of these agencies to help, to combat waste, fraud, and abuse? Is it going to be like budgeting, or is it going to be like employee replacement or contractor replacement? Because I'm sure there's going to be a lot of that. Where, kind of where do you guys, see the areas that are ripe for it, and where do you think we're going to innovate first or kind of move into first?
You want to take that day first?
Oh no,
Let
I was gonna let you, because I know you're doing that work at IRS, and you've gotten lots of kudos for that. So.
Yeah, I think it's going to, and again, it's a lot of the agencies are slow in adopting it, which there's efficiencies that could be addressed right now just by adopting in the analytics space, for example, and being able to understand your. So one problem that we have is whenever you have a new project, you have all this subject matter expertise that you need to capture from projects. And so using generative AI and like chatbots to capture that knowledge is important, because whenever you have a contractor move from one project, or you have a project, it's ended and the incumbent doesn't win, somebody else takes over, it's almost like starting over from scratch. And being able to have a assistant that can tell you everything about the data, where to get the data, knowing everything about your data, everything about the project, that can take months of time to onboard. And so I can see that being a big use of generative AI right now, is just understanding, know your data, know your project, and onboarding, and actually capturing subject matter expertise and was it knowledge transfer.
So I'll piggyback on that. But John Mark, I also think you have some great fraud examples. But one of the things to think about AI is that in many instances, like other technologies that preceded it, it will make other technologies better, right? So the example John Mark just gave is it goes back to knowledge management, right? Knowledge management was a big, this is going to change the world. We're going to, know where all of our knowledge is. We'll be able to use it. There'll be huge repositories, and we'll be able to access that information at any time. And I think the reality was, while it was a great idea, the capabilities and the technologies just couldn't support it the way that would make sense for most people. I think AI, with its ability to source through that information quickly, to make sense of it quickly, really helps now make knowledge management a reality, right?
Absolutely.
Especially when you're talking about that, so the fraud, for example, you have all these data sources and hundreds of tables, data sources that aren't relational. There can be no SQL, and knowing everything about those data sources is critical. But you can go in now and for example, ask a question. Assuming you have the data catalog and all that knowledge available to an agent or a large language model, you can go in and quickly identify, where can I find this? I'm interested in finding out how this money is being spent. And you could spend a month going down the wrong path because you're looking at data sources that are just old or not used. And that quickly can get you up and have you solve. You can solve a or answer a question pretty quickly as an analyst, saving you months of time and not having to go through all the data catalogs, figuring out where the data is and whatnot. Just being able to say, hey, how do I solve this? What's the best data sources? And you can actually build the queries and whatnot for each individual. Like if you're using a system like a graph database or Elasticsearch or a relational database, it can actually, you can have agents that will go in and they're specialized in those query language, can run those queries and give you feedback so you can kind of fine tune and focus in on what you're looking for. And things that I've seen take months or even up to a year to figure out how to solve one type of problem can be, the first day you can be out and know kind of the approach you're going to take just by the assistance of using Gen AI.
It's fantastic. Yeah, and it's really going to be obviously like managing massive amounts of data is going to be huge. I think an area I've been thinking about is like pattern recognition. When you look at analytics, when you start thinking about like CMS, right? CMS is they're huge, one of the largest pay like insurance payers in the country. When you think about the amount of data that they process on a daily basis, how do you even begin to start digging through it and looking for patterns, right? For patterns. And even if the AI agents at this point can only get you, call it 50% of the way through an analysis and like be like, okay, here's the areas we're not sure about. This is where you should focus. That saves huge amounts of time. And if that's contracted out, that saves huge amounts of money for the government, right?
Another area for pattern recognition and fraud identity-based systems has to do with State Department, right? Visas, those kinds of documents. Because one of the things the State Department has an issue with is that as they're adjudicating visas, Because it's a global world, many of those systems have a hard time distinguishing names, right? The spelling of a name can be slightly different, and that can throw off the entire process for granting somebody a visa. And so when you think about, in Europe, a consular officer on the front line going to a system and running a check, many times those systems don't have the capability and the knowledge and the experience to help that consular officer think through, well, is this person who they say they are? And I think that's an area where AI with, pattern recognition analysis, can support what a consular officer does on the front lines.
Yeah, I've always been curious what they could do from hooked into the IC from a raw intel perspective and a raw intel analysis perspective, right? That and we with your guys' backgrounds, we won't get too far into that, but I think that that's an area that's really interesting. I think that also you're absolutely right of understanding not just pr like processing folks coming into the country, but also thinking about people that overstay visas, because I think that's one of the largest areas of problems of illegal immigration. And understanding, I would assume that they could see from a like check flights and check at way place people would go out of the country and flag them as, hey, these people are probably still here, things like that. Also, I'm not sure what else.
And well,
Well,
oh, sorry.
go ahead, John.
I was going to mention the trend, even though it seems it's, we've always had translation software and whatnot, but the way that, the way from what I've been researching and learning about large language models is if you do translations, you can actually get more to the concept. It's not a direct translate. It's like a, what would you say, a language to language translation. So you can understand something without having a, tr usually you have to have a translator come in and there's the way you say something might mean something different. And that right now with large language models, you can actually go in and have it do not necessarily the large language model on its own, but you can do translations in real time without having to have actual translators there because it's translating them, it's translating your concept into this conceptual item and then translating it to the language itself. And so that actually makes it efficient for you to ask questions and not get, you use like a older type of translation software. What you ask or what someone responds back to might mean something completely different than what they intended to be. So that's why you still have translators that come in when you're, if you're at the DHS or, you're at the border, if you speak a language that if they don't usually use software that try doing the translations, it's always a human that comes in. I think that's going to actually be changing. I think Facebook actually is the four, they're kind of fronting that and really making it more efficient.
Interesting. Yeah, I was I was at the recently I was at this AI symposium at the French embassy, and one of the speakers, she works for the French consulate, said that something that she had done that I found really interesting, I'd never heard of this before. So she grew up and came up in France and came through the French university system, and the way that they communicate and pitch things in France is different than here in the US. And so she's been able to essentially take things that take pitches, take ideas, take thoughts that she had, and essentially had it analyze it and rework it as if it was if as if it had gone to an American university and was American. Interestingly, though, the inverse didn't work as well. So if you had an American idea and you wanted to get it to run through like the French university thought process, it didn't do it as well as the other way, which I just found really interesting.
That's very interesting.
Well,
My wife is.
I was going to say I won't make a comment about the French perception of Americans, and maybe that's was a bias in the model. But
I can joke about that all the time because my wife is French,
yeah.
and so she went to a French law school and whatnot, and I have so many jokes about this. She wouldn't be too happy if she heard me
I won't ask you to repeat any of them, but I have questions, Jean-Marc. Absolutely. So as we start looking at implementing this in a lot of different ways, what are some of the some of the for I mean, before we go there, obviously I think there's a lot of hesitation that you guys have mentioned a couple of times in rolling this out. Is that related to do you think it's a just a resistance to change that can be inherent within people in general? Or do you think there's like security concerns associated with a lot of the technology and where the data is going to end up and like who, what servers are the model hosted on and how all of that get works, or both?
Yeah, everything. So there's all these unknowns about how does it work. When you ask something, how does the neural net answer? How do you try to attack bias? It's all in the training data. If you train it on a certain amount of data, it's gonna, it's just statistical. It's gonna come back and be biased if you. And people don't understand that. I think right now, like OpenAI and other teams are trying to work on the bias aspect of it to show, they've got like the, what is it, the chain of thought. They try to, they used to show it. I think they removed it once that DeepSeek started
Deep
using
seek.
it. But yeah, that and you can poison models, and there's a lot of unknowns that I think that people don't understand. And then obviously the people worrying about secure, if you're using retrieval augmented generation, you've got to send that information back to whatever is processing, that's doing the inference. And so, you need to have mechanisms to be able to ensure that certain data is blocked. And just there's so many new things right now that that all these agencies are trying to figure out, and they're learning new things every day. And I think the security piece, you can run these models like Llama, and you can run DeepSeek local. You'd never want to use DeepSeek in the government using the inference running in China, but you can run all these models locally and address some of these issues. But I think it's everything. It's the unknowns, it's resistance to change. I don't know how long that's going to last, but I'm starting to see more and more people there more accepting it's the management we've seen are kind of giving it a chance, saying, right, let's try this in a small area and see how it helps. Maybe not for coming up with tax compliance or cybersecurity. Imagine it coming up with cybersecurity rules, and it's been poisoned, and it's recommending like algorithms that have already been compromised. But there's so much. I have no idea, but I bet you it's everything. It's a mixture of everything.
Yeah, and I would just add, I think this is going to be an area where we don't necessarily see government leading the way, right? Some of these things will be solved in the private sector. And as companies really begin to, use the technology and show more competence in it, government will eventually follow. So, unfortunately, the issue I've seen in government over the years is that, they're not typically early adopters, right? They're laggards. But once that model is proven to a point where they can accept it, you'll see them come along, right? You'll see, now there's no. There's no concern with government over doing e-commerce, right? When the internet, first came out, government was not, if you had a government credit card, you could not order on a website because they were so concerned with, e-commerce as a model.
Interesting. No, that's fantastic. That's really interesting. And I do you think that that's like a good thing that they're slow to adopt? Should they be faster to adopt?
So my personal view is that there are some things that government should do faster in terms of adoption. There's many times there's low-hanging fruit with AI. John Mark has talked about some of those. But government tends to get caught in a some of it's bureaucratic. Right, we need our own AI policy and our own experts, to look at it to understand how we should use it. So from that perspective, I think sometimes government gets in its own way. As a whole, in trying to just, be, I don't know that government should ever try to be the first mover, right, with some of this technology, that there's too much at risk, right, for government to do that.
John Mark, anything to add on that?
I think the vendors, it's going to end up being the vendors and the service providers that will, be input. They'll be make it more competitive, so you can come in under cost. It can cut costs huge amounts if you don't need a stack, a whole team of developers, for example, to deliver something. But I'm not sure. That's one of the areas I've always thought about. I like to push stuff fast, and I've learned from experience that it's not good to do that, and you'll have resistance. So I think it's going to end up being the private, like you said, the private sectors are going to come and start making it more efficient, then it will slowly move in, and it can help. I mean, already just delivering solutions and cutting the cost on those deliveries are going to it's going to be hard to justify spending $20 million on something when another vendor that has the same qualifications and past performance comes in and says, "Oh, I can do it for $500,000."
Absolutely.
So John Mark, that's a good example. And to me, that's an area that is kind of uniquely government, that government should be more out in front, right? And so when you look at something like acquisitions, right, and you look at that entire chain of what happens to, occur for government to buy something, that's an area that's just full of inefficiency, right? Government, hiring, acquisition, procurement folks, and having a backlog in order to hire more people, to do what? In many cases, to review proposals, to do things that AI can certainly help government do it better, faster, smarter, right? And so, to me, that's an area because it's a key function of what the government does in order to operate that AI can make and should be making a much larger contribution that would help save lots of money for the government as a whole.
Absolutely. And they're aware of that in the acquisition area, in acquisition shops, right? I host an event series. The last one was in October. Well, the first one was in October. It was also the last one, where we bring government folks on site, and we actually have I have a whole spiel about this, but I think there's only two networking events that people go to. It's either a happy hour or it's like a speaker or a panel. And if it's an
Right.
all-day event, it's just more speakers and panels and then a happy hour. Like it's that's it. Like that's it. That's all I got. So a buddy of mine and I have we've started we're in the process of turning it into a nonprofit right now. It's easier to spin up a for-profit, so that was the first event. But we had CEOs and cores from about 8 or 9 different agencies on site in conjunct with industry. We ran design thinking exercises where the government was looking for low cost, no cost solutions specifically to four common areas within the government procurement that we've worked out, we discovered through the overall discovery call. And so, that's where you're actually, talking to a CEO or core. You had every, it was one at every single table. We were all, we had the sticky notes and we were doing like true design thinking. And then, and then they did a desirability and feasibility matrix on their top 20 ideas that they selected, just feedback direct from the government, which is something that is difficult to get. I've seen a lot of different areas from, whether it's helping a lot of different areas, like areas where AI is already helping with that, whether it's in like sitter review programs and doing upfront reviews of the initial submissions and then route and then helping to route the proposals to the right support analyst who's going to review them through, compliance checks within the government and seeing whether or not, you get 150 proposals. How many of them are actually compliant? How many do I need to read, right? Through also, frankly, a lot of the procurement systems that they use on the back end are they don't talk to each other, right? And so you and like as you create a source of thought and you move it through the process to RFI, RFQ, RFP, and a lot of that is literally taking the same information and moving it from one document to another document because it's not doing it for you, right? And so I think acquisition is a great area for it's rife for efficiency. Right. And then I think on the other side, I would like to also see if we could, if there are ways to help cut down on protests, whether it's pre-award, post-award, because I mean, two vehicles, a CIO SP4 and T4NG2, I think have been both, I think one's a VA vehicle, the other's a CMS vehicle, have been held up in protest for, I know CIO SP4 has been a couple of years now. I know T4NG2 just got kicked, I think over the summer, got kicked back, and the government has to reevaluate the entirety of all the bids. And so, do you think that having AI in the acquisition process will help with some of that, some of the protest activity, and or not? And if yes, why? And if not, why?
I think so. I think using Gen AI for creating the actual the RFIs and RFQs and making sure that they're standardized and written in a way that can help prevent protests. I don't know what the common reasons are for protests, but you could easily take all those docs and either fine-tune a model or use it with RAG, and you can come up with something that makes it fair, I guess, is the key, and make sure that it's written in a way that would I guess lessen the likelihood of protests, if that makes sense. And then obviously, because the vendors are probably all using AI anyway to respond,
Largely.
and I'm assuming they're writing, hey, what's the best, what are their protestable issues on this, based on everything. So everything could go through like a reviewer that's a middle person that says, hey, look, don't respond to these questions and answers this way because it will lead to a protest. Write it this way. The goal is just to make it fair, but humans make a lot of mistakes. I bet you they'd cut down on the protests by using Gen AI for the RFIs. And it'd be more detailed too. If you've ever seen RFIs that come out and they look geared, then you're like, oh, is this geared towards someone? Or is this actually just because it was written in a way that they didn't understand the technology, or there was a miscommunication between the people asking for it and the COs, if I'm using the right terminology. So I could see that would be a huge area where Gen AI, and they could it could be done now. I mean, it's not there's nothing that really needs to be developed, just some workflows and processes.
Right. Well, I'll just add that, John Mark, you brought up humans, and I don't want to denigrate our species, but
This
is many
pesky human.
times, many times, the evaluation of a proposal is ultimately a subjective right decision. And so that is ultimately why companies protest, because they can't make sense of the decision that was made. And if you've ever gone through a protest, once you get down to the point where somebody has to provide a response, you typically get a response that doesn't satisfy your original, issue or complaint. And so if, the ability for, AI to go through the RFPs and say, hey, look, we've scored these, we've ranked these from, 1 to 100. This is why this one's 100 based off of all of our criteria. This is why this one is a 98, right? And then you remove some of that subjectivity so that, frankly, I think it gives the government an opportunity to say, hey, look, this is how it was scored. It was based off of a model. It wasn't me injecting my own personal bias, right, into a decision of, which contractor I may have favored or what do I know about this company as opposed to somebody else. So I think it can help tremendously.
It's fascinating. I appreciate it. How critical are like the data infrastructure and data governance going to be to a successful implementation of some of these AI systems across the government?
Going to be so having knowledge of all the data that you have, know your data, which I took that term from, was it AML, know your customer, KYC, knowing the data, being able to have the power of the process. So the biggest issue, is going to be the inference, like the power and the compute to be able to do the inference and whatnot. But having that in a available, so assuming that that's available, I think that's a key piece, is having the power, the compute. I'm trying to remember. I'm going back in time. I forgot what the question was, so I'm trying to do that without looking like a
Infrastructure, data infrastructure, data governance. And then, as a follow-up to that, John Mark, in your experience, understand this is a personal subjective opinion that I'm asking for. How is the government doing from a data governance and data infrastructure perspective? And I understand it's going to be agency by agency.
Yes, I think they're still planning. They've got some good ideas that some of the ideas for governance are kind of going away when we learn more about how these large language models are working. So they should at least start auditing and logging every interaction with an AI, either if it's through a chat, if it's a tool that's using APIs and whatnot. They need to start capturing this information now so they can go backwards in time and say, hey, here's like a model that was poisoned. What did it touch on? How was it being used? But the governance piece, I know from experience with the agencies we work with, they haven't implemented it. They're talking about it, but there's no, I don't, I'm not sure if they know how to implement it exactly yet. There hasn't been I haven't seen at least anybody implementing a governance program that they say, all right, this is it, this is what we want to use, and maybe everyone else will share it across their organizations and whatnot. So that's going to be an issue, is they have to come up and figure out how do they do explainability. That's going to be hard when the companies that build these large language models are still trying to figure out how to explain why the responses are coming back the way they are.
Absolutely.
So it's still, like you said, it's very early on. I'd say, the biggest thing is start auditing everything, just log every interaction, and then you can come back to it. And a lot of agencies aren't even doing that. So, from using ChatGPT or Gemini or Grok or any of these models, anytime you ask it a question or say, hey, look at this policy or whatnot, you need to be able to see what was asked and what the response was. So you can come back once you get these governance rules in place, to see if you were following those the whole time, and what could have been biased, what could have been affecting the responses. I mean, it's still so early on that I bet you it'll be a year or two before there's actually a formal, a governance architecture that's like adopted throughout, that everyone agrees that's the way to go. Let's all implement it this way.
How are they doing on the data infrastructure side?
Data infrastructure, I don't think there's a big issue. I mean, you've got the cloud. A lot of agencies have all the air gapped, and but they still have the big companies that come in and set up those big platforms. You've got all these open source tools that can handle huge amounts of data, like Cassandra and NoSQL, MongoDB and whatnot. So it's and then you've got Azure, and I don't think the data infrastructure is an issue now. Having the GPUs and whatnot, that's a big issue. That's
So
probably going to be the biggest issue, because you got to have those. You've got to have for inference, you got to have a huge amount of processing power and energy for it, and the GPUs themselves. And so, from what I've understood right now, there's all the big tech companies are buying up most of the compute, like from the NVIDIA chips and whatnot. So it's gonna be interesting to see as it gets more adopted. Like right now, if everyone just adopted a generative AI and the inference alone, we might not have enough power to handle it.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
One thing I was just going to add, but to me, again, that's an example where, government being a laggard isn't necessarily such a bad thing. By the time government really begins to use this in a way that it becomes part of, the everyday, operating mode, industry will have solved it. The price point will have come down, right? And I think it there will be stories of success in how to implement it, right? I think it's much harder when government, tries to maybe get ahead of industry for something like this.
Yeah, I'd also venture a guess that there's going to be a difference in the attitudes and approach on the civilian side versus the defense side versus the IC. And I would also say that there's probably going to be more urgency from an adoption perspective in the DoD and IC space than it would
Absolutely.
civilian side. I think that's a competition, geopolitical competition is gonna ensure that we need to, press ahead there. Whereas, an example I used earlier with CMS and waste, fraud, and abuse, they have a process for that now. I don't know how efficient it is. I'm not an expert in how in their effectiveness. However, they're gonna be a little bit more risk averse, I would say.
I think there's another example related to fraud that we should discuss, and that is just when you look at the fraud or the waste that occurs with how government needs to react fast, right? So when you look at something like COVID, right, and the number of vendors and companies that were able to get loans, but the amount of fraud that was, as a result of that, I think that that's something that AI can, again, help with. Like your CMS example, and I think to me the ultimate beneficiary of that is, not just the government, right, but the people who need to be helped, right, taxpayers, who are able to save money. And so that's for me. That's why, I'm very, very, optimistic about what the future holds for, government being able to take advantage of AI.
Absolutely. I would also say I agree with you completely. Like you look at, I mean, it's a great example of doing something fast. The government also need to spend less money on the contractors reviewing all of these as well, because I would assume they're going to have something set up for all, they will have something set up for loans already. And they'll be able to just move that over, redeploy a model, I would assume. I don't know if I'm using the proper technical term, but we're rolling with it. So, feel free to correct me, John Mark, please.
They'll start using more agents, and then obviously it costs more and more. The more agents you have, the more compute that you need. And keep in mind too that there's like zero shot. Like, so when you use ChatGPT or and I'll just use them as an example. They're like the Coke of the when you have a trademark like
They're the Uber of ride sharing, right? Like you just Uber everywhere, even if you're using Lyft, right? Google of search, right? It's,
Exactly. But they have in terms of infrastructure, you have the zero shot where you'll pass it some docs and ask a question. But when it starts to get into reasoning, it can be really expensive in compute. Like, I think ChatGPT is probably losing money on their O1 Pro, the $200 a month offering they have. But it's going to be a big issue when you need to have reasoning tasks. So there's going to be like a mix where you're going to have the human and the zero shot together are going to be cheaper alternative than using reasoning. Like, it might cost $50 to answer one question. But I could see, like with fraud, what you're talking about is having it, not using it specifically to identify fraud as in real time data, but maybe designing the algorithm that's sitting there watching for fraud. I could see, that first step would be there, is having AI come up and give ideas for, novel type fraud. Somebody trying to come in and maybe layer something in a way that's never been seen before. That's where you can start using generative AI to come up with, hey, what are some ideas or what are some ways that we can identify these layering techniques, but build a solution in the, or build an algorithm, let's say, or an API, I'll just call it algorithm, and deploying it. But at some point you're going to be able to actually monitor in real time, the data, and not have to give it, let the reasoning come and say, hey, we're going to go and well we it's going to go in and say, I'm going to go and implement these three things to watch for, and it can do it all autonomously. That's going to be soon, but not yet. But it's all about compute, though. If we don't have enough compute and power, it's you need a lot of it to really make it work well.
Absolutely. And so, what do you think? How do you think the government should be addressing some of the compute bandwidth, compute issues, especially considering the proximity of a lot of these factories to, in fact, they're into a lot of, I think most over half the world's semiconductor plants and chips are made in Taiwan. How should the government be addressing that? How should they?
That's actually pretty interesting. I haven't so I don't watch a lot of TV and news, but I heard about the new program that was there's like $1 billion being put into, or some a large amount being put into creating factories and whatnot here in the US. For it's gonna be an issue because you have like the work ethic and everything in Taiwan. It would be very hard to replicate what's in Taiwan, I think, and bring it into the US. But yeah, that's going to be a big issue because China, if they wanted to, I think if I understand it right, they still consider Taiwan part of their territory. So I would think that if they're being what's it called when you have they're being blocked from having access to certain GPUs. I forgot what that's called. Not a tariff. It's a export
Embargo, export
embargo.
control, and that, or and I think embargo is right. Export import controls, I think, is part of it. But I think you're right.
But imagine they just say, all right, well, we're going to hurt everyone. If you're trying to hurt us, they could block it. And then that can really affect us if we don't, there's a lot of issues that are up in the air that could, change at any moment. And having the ability to have the processors and the compute here in the US, I'm guessing would be good. I'm guessing that's why they did that.
I mean, to me, that's the ultimate critical infrastructure question, right? Which is, what does the United States really need to be able to source on its own in order to be able to continue its policies and globally and I think that's a question that a lot of people have been looking at, and it's one that probably needs to be addressed sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think, a big wake-up call for me relating to supply chain issues specifically was, you remember during COVID, medications largely made overseas, and that's another issue. And again, as we think about this in a geopolitical from a geopolitical lens through a geopolitical lens from that perspective, right? These are absolutely things that we should be addressing. I also think that we should be addressing like data as critical infrastructure. When you think about the how important training data is to building these systems, like you can't do it without it, and how important these systems are going to, like, being the leader in these systems is going to be to continuing our kind of, like, let's just say global dominance over the next 100 years. I think, treating data as a critical infrastructure is another area we should really focus
I
on.
agree.
There's another probably key piece of critical infrastructure, although it's not a piece of equipment, and that's people, right? And so when you think about AI, one of the things that government absolutely has to do is to begin to get more people who understand these systems, right? That's going to be part of the adoption, right? Having people who know how to write prompts correctly, right? Having people who know how to, interpret and review the results. And so the ability to just, get more people skills in AI, I think is a critical part of all of this.
I agree. I also think retention from a U.S. government perspective is absolutely critical. I've talked to several CDAO offices, and they've told me that they've had trouble when you think about like government compensation versus industry compensation, right? There's not a huge drastic difference in a lot of areas, and in some places the GS scale is going to be better than industry, right? But this is not one of them, right? You can't. I think the GS scale caps out around 200K a year, and that's a huge pay cut for a lot of the people that work in this space, right? And like doing it for the country and loyalty, that'll get you so far, right? I don't know how many hundreds of thousands that'll take off. I'm not sure where that is, and I know it'll be person by person, but like that's an absolute issue from a comp perspective, right? Would you guys agree?
Oh,
Yeah.
100%.
How do you think the government should affect, how do you think the government should address that? Should they have like a special set aside, a special carve out, or are these things they should be thinking about like at a, in Congress?
I'm not sure. I'm not. I meant being able to open up high tech. So a lot of people coming from European universities and whatnot, being able to bring them in and getting that knowledge share or the expertise is one thing. What are the H1B visas?
No, it's not an H1. I want to say that's a something for H4 visa. I don't remember. There's a whole bunch of them. H1s are, people that come in that are skilled labor, I believe. I think the student visa is a different one. But again, that's like doesn't matter. Those folks can't work on any federal, like they can work on some federal contracts, but they can't work on anything, defense related or justice related things like that. How do you think what do you think the new Department of Government Efficiency should be considering as they integrate AI into government operations?
I think addressing the low-hanging fruit, as Dave mentioned, would be the first, addressing things that we know you can use generative AI. And again, I keep talking about generative AI. There's so much more, but that would be one is how do you tackle that low-hanging fruit, and then you can figure out how to do the more complex issues as the reasoning models and whatnot get better. Like next year, they'll be twice as good, or I don't know if twice, but they'll be much better. So hitting the low-hanging fruit, identifying issues where you have a lot of people there doing the same thing, like answering like help desks and reviewing documents. You can have a few experts or a few subject matter experts powered by or augmented by generative AI right now that could cut off a huge amount of work. Well, I don't want to say it because that's bad. You're cutting off workforce, but you can definitely cut down on the amount of people or resources you need to do certain jobs right now, and while keeping the humans there for oversight and whatnot,
Absolutely.
until you create Skynet and it takes over.
There's that. That's why we need human in the loop, no matter what, from a decision-making perspective, right? Is you can't give it, and my conspiracy side is what really worries me is if we give AI the ability to act without our authority, right? Or if we don't have a human in the loop everywhere, that's where I worry that the system's gonna, because we all have seen the system, hallucinate, system failures, what have you. We've seen all of that happen, and it's low stakes if you're asking it to, explain something to you, but it gets much, much higher stakes if it's in charge of, launching weapons or something, right? Or, I think that there's absolutely some high stakes and low stakes areas, but appreciate it. Dave, anything you want to add to that?
No, I think you're spot on. In terms of what DOGE should be looking at, it's all of those things, but I think where DOGE can really be a leader is in helping bring industry best practices, industry, ideas that work into government, right? Being that conduit, and not just simply being an implementer. And so I think that's how you're ultimately going to make all of this adoption something that sticks right beyond, any kind of, political agenda.
Absolutely. I agree. I think like unfortunately there's a lot of politics involved in this at the moment. However, I think that making the government more efficient and doing so and saving both and saving money and making increasing efficiency, I think everybody's on the same page about that. As we get ready to wrap up, Dave, John Mark, anything that you'd like to add, anything that I missed, any points you'd like to make that I didn't ask about?
Not on my end, John Mark.
Awesome.
Not mine. Just to keep in mind that there are, there's going to be a lot of issues. Even using things slowly and introducing them slowly, having like poison model. When I say poison, it could be models that are biased a certain direction. They could slowly work. So you might start using the models to do something very specific. Such as helping with procurements and whatnot. But imagine, that these models have been built in a way that they slowly guide it one direction. And it doesn't matter, it could take 4 years, but imagine you start using them to start creating procurements, and in reality they've been poisoned in a way that they're creating it so it's more inefficient, or they're creating security concerns and whatnot. So there's issues that have to be addressed on how to explainability in the governance side of things. So as you can imagine, that you want to guide you create a model and you say, hey, whatever this question is asked, you always want to guide these algorithms because we know this class of algorithm can be easily cracked by quantum computers.
Mm-hmm.
For 5 years from now, it's the slow approach. So there's a lot of issues that maybe the models that you're using, the companies that are creating them might need to release more than just the models themselves. You know, how did they train it? The code maybe. There's a lot of stuff that I'm guessing needs to be done before the government can really trust them.
Absolutely. I would say before anybody can really trust it, right? It also depends on how you're using it, right? There's a low stakes way and a high stakes way to do it. And I think that, as long as we're smart and about how we implement it and do it slowly. And then Jean-Marc, to your point, logging every single question and answer, doing that all in a way that I would assume the AI system doesn't have access to. So we can't go in and change the records. And then, studying it over time and seeing, are there other things that we should be doing to help prevent some of the potential like poison pills being, introduced to these models?
I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that we should be doing, but that could be a whole other podcast.
I'd love to do one on that because I think that's absolutely fascinating. Today, gentlemen, I really appreciate you both coming on Robots and Red Tape. Thank you so much. I appreciate your perspectives and I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're both very busy.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Thank you for listening to Robots and Red Tape, everybody. Have a great day.